Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the June 9th, 2021 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning. This is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for review on the Rhode Island Housing website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners, and specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback and background noise, we ask the commissioners and participating staff to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. During the meeting, anyone who is having technical difficulty with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. This is Carol Ventura. Corinne Myers, Acting General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning. This is Corinne Myers speaking. Pursuant to Executive Order 2046, which was most recently extended by Executive Order 2159 and may be further extended from time to time, this meeting is being held by teleconference. Members of the public can visit the RI Housing website to visit today's agenda and information on each of the actions being taken. If the teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until we can reconnect and audio is restored. Committee Chairman Kevin Orth will preside this morning. Commissioners and staff, please remember to state your name each and every time prior to speaking. And again, when you are not speaking, please do mute your telephone to minimize background noise. Now I will turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
This is Kevin Orth. Thank you, Corinne. Thank you, Carolyn and CJ. Now I'd like to call the meeting to order. And I'd like to ask Carol to conduct a roll call attendance vote, please.
Thank you, Commissioner Orth. I will now conduct a roll call of Credit Committee members, Board of Commissioners in attendance, and staff of Rhode Island Housing. Chairman Nicholas Retsinas.
Here.
Commissioner Kevin Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Liz Tanner.
Here.
Staff of Rhode Island Housing. James Comer.
Here.
Lisa Primiano.
Here.
Carol LaChapelle.
Here.
Ian Berman.
Here.
Michael Libatori.
Here.
Jeff Swanson.
Here.
Milton Baxter.
Here.
Corinne Myers.
Here.
CJ Rotella.
Here.
Commissioner Ott, the roll call is complete.
Great. Thanks, Carol. For this agenda, I'd like to make one small change to it, and that is in the discussion section. I'd like to move up the discussion of the fiscal year 2022 operating budget to the first item. I think that's going to require a fair amount of discussion. I'd like to make sure we can get through that thoroughly. And with that, we'll jump right into the committee action item number one, which is the approval of the minutes for our previous meeting held on May 12, 2021. I'd like to request a motion to approve.
Liz Tanner, so move.
Second.
And Corinne, we got a second there? Okay. Any comments or discussion on that item? Hearing none, Corinne, would you please conduct a roll call vote?
This is Corinne. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of approving the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on May 12, 2021, say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Retsinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. Thank you.
Great, thanks. I'd like to move on to action item number two, which is a recommendation for firm approval of financing of the Forest Farms Assisted Living Project. I'd like to introduce Milton Baxter, Development Officer, who will present this item. Milton?
Thank you, Commissioner Orth.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Milton Baxter, Development Officer at Rhode Island Housing. Before the committee this morning for requesting recommendation for firm approval to the Board of Commissioners is a refinancing transaction for Forest Farm Assisted Living. This is being advanced by its sponsor, Church Community Housing Corporation. Forest Farm is an existing assisted living facility that is licensed by the Rhode Island Department of Health and is located in Middletown, Rhode Island. It was originally built in 1999 using low-income housing tax credits and other financing. The facility is a single building that currently has 51-bedroom assisted living apartments. It includes a commercial kitchen, resident dining room, library, and other common area activity rooms. The facility is attached to the Royal Middletown Nursing Center, which is set on idyllic grounds in Middletown. Forest Farm has a contractual relationship with an affiliate of Royal as a third-party service provider to provide meals and assisted living services to the residents. The end of the initial LIHTC compliance period was in 2014, and in 2015, the equity investor, which was National Equity Fund, exited the limited partnership. Church Community is proposing this refinancing to undertake a substantial rehabilitation of the project. As you can imagine, for a property that is almost 23 years old, many of the building systems and interior finishes are at or nearing the end of their useful life and require replacement. The capital improvement budget is a $4.5 million undertaking, which plans to update unit interiors with paint, flooring, lighting, and appliances, and also replacing the roof, installing solar panels, replacing boilers and hot water tanks with new efficient systems, installing new and efficient heat pumps for each unit to improve heating and cooling within the units, upgrading the sprinkler and fire alarm systems, upgrading the emergency generator that's on site, and making some site improvements. This matter was before the committee and the board back in February of this year for preliminary approval. Since preliminary approval, you may note from the write-up that there has been an increase in the budget of about $43,000. And part of that was an increase in construction costs of $130,000 and some moving around of some of the other costs and expenses and dialing into the actual costs of some of the projections. And that is a $43,000 increase in the project budget. The developer has 100% construction plans or drawings that have been completed, and the project has been fully bid by subcontractors, so the construction number has been locked in that regard. There haven't been any significant changes in scope as a result of that as well, so we're pretty happy with that in light of the current construction cost environment. I think that's all I have for in terms of the summary. I'd be happy to take any questions that anyone might have.
Great. Thank you very much, Milton. I'd like to request a motion to recommend approval of committee action item number 2.
Liz Tanner, so moved.
Second.
Great. Thank you very much. Now we can open it up for discussion or questions. Liz or Nick?
I have a couple of questions. One, I'm just sort of curious. Assisted living is an interesting part of the market. It looks like it's going to be revolutionary in terms of what it's going to mean for people, but over time it hasn't performed in the marketplace. What's our track record with assisted living?
I think Ann might be able to speak a little more to the historical track record we've had with assisted living.
Sure. Good morning, Nick. This is Ann Berman.
Good morning.
Forest Farm was actually the first assisted living project that that Rhode Island Housing financed. You may recall that in the late 1990s, early 2000s, the Department of Health, I think in conjunction with the Department of Elderly Affairs, set aside 200 assisted living Medicaid waivers for essentially to be dedicated to projects that were financed with low-income housing tax credits. So ultimately, Rhode Island Housing financed 3 facilities And I believe 151 of the Medicaid waivers, they don't technically use the word project-based, but they're essentially dedicated to these three facilities. It's this one, Franklin Court Assisted Living in Bristol, and St. Elizabeth Assisted Living in Providence. It's been a bit of a rocky history. I mean, at one point, the Department of Health, about 2 years after they signed all these contracts, decided to renege on the contracts, and the facilities had to sue to get it back. And then, you know, there was no increase in payment standards for a long time. That's been remedied over the last couple of years. I think most the three assisted livings are all much more stable than they have been. I know Mike DeCaro can speak a little bit more in detail about the operations, but, you know, I think overall these facilities have filled a gap, a significant gap in the market, because they're providing assisted living to folks who essentially have incomes below 30% AMI. Most of them have a market rate. Most of these facilities have some market rate housing, so the facilities are really quite lovely and really have all the amenities that you would find in a market rate facility. And in this particular case, in the case of Forest Farm, because they've now secured 30 project-based vouchers, we believe that the operations are going to be much more stable moving forward. They have sort of a unique model with the pass-through on the services. But overall, it's really been a tremendous niche in the market.
Good, thank you. That's very helpful. One last question. Since Ann just said it's had a rocky history, I suppose a special relationship with the Medicaid waivers and the like, are we comfortable that the reserves are sufficient given this rocky history?
Yes, I we've taken a look at that. I mean, we really drilled down on examining the costs and the expenses of operating the facility and the income involved, and you know, based on the current information available, best information available, we are comfortable that the reserves are adequately sized to protect any issues that they may have in operations. And you know, again, based on the historical operations and based on the current status of their operating budget and their income, we are comfortable.
And last comment.
If I could jump in, Milton, it's Mike DeCaro. Mm-hmm. Just add a little bit more color to Forest Farm. So, as Ann said, all of our assisted livings have, you know, we've struggled through the last 10, 15 years using reserves up over those years when we were getting no increases in the Medicaid waivers. Forest Farm in particular, we were below 1.0 debt coverage ratio for several years. But I think the important thing here is those 30 project-based vouchers. Even with COVID, and they had some longer-term vacancies than typical properties because it was assisted living and the restrictions weren't allowing visitors. They had trouble turning over units. They still operated. We just reviewed their 2020 audit. They still operated at a 1.24 debt coverage ratio with those, maybe 6 months worth of those project-based vouchers in there. So there's certainly an upward trend, and as long as those vouchers are stable, I think we're not very concerned with the operating in the future.
Good, thank you. My only last comment is I take some solace that one of our developers always does a good job in the church community, and I'm glad to see they're one of the partners in this venture, an important partner. Thank you.
I had a quick question regarding the rents. I see that I guess we're still in about 15 years left on the compliance period, at least for tax credits. I just want to make sure that I guess there are five units not covered by the vouchers, that those rents are within the tax credit requirements, as shown on page 5. It seems like that might not be the case, but I'm assuming that's just a presentation issue.
I'm trying to access page 5 so I can speak to that, but one moment, please. Of course, my computer isn't cooperating, but here we go. Okay. So there are going to be 5 market rate units that are included in this, and I'll have to confirm with the regulatory agreement that these rents actually do comply with the existing regulatory agreement under the initial LIHTC project. I don't have that information directly in front of me. I can certainly locate it. However, based on our initial analysis and the presentation in the information presented by the developer, we do believe that this will be in compliance, and if not, we will adjust accordingly. We think that there's still room within the project budget and the income to still achieve our requirements if there needs to be an adjustment.
Okay, good. And then secondly, have you received the sign-off sheet from various departments for this?
Yes.
Okay. Kevin, this is Ann. I apologize. I do have those, and I'll send them to you right after this meeting. We have them for this one and River Edge, and apologies for not circulating them ahead of time.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Good. Those are all my questions. Liz, any comments or questions?
I'm all set.
Okay, great. Thank you. Corinne, would you please conduct a roll call vote?
Certainly. This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of recommending firm approval of financing for Forest Farms Assisted Living, say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Ritsina?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Now I'd like to move to action item number 3, which is the recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for River Edge Apartments. And I'd like to introduce Jeffrey Swanson, Real Estate Development Officer, who will present this action item. Jeff?
This is Jeff Swanson. Good morning and thank you. Today we're here to request preliminary commitment of a tax-exempt construction loan of $16.1 million. This will be a construction-to-permanent loan with $10.5 million remaining as the permanent amortizing first mortgage. This request is a result of a 4% low-income housing tax credit application for River Edge Apartments, which was submitted by Cornell Management Corporation. This project is the acquisition and rehabilitation of an existing Section 8 property located in the Olneyville neighborhood of Providence. River Edge is a single six-story building with a total of 99 units. There are 89 one-bedroom and 10 two-bedroom units. All 99 units are encumbered by the Section 8 HAP contract. The building was constructed in 1980. The current partnership acquired the property in February 2006, so they have a fairly lengthy track record with the property. At the time, they used a combination of bond financing and LIHTC credits issued through Rhode Island Housing. Their initial 15-year compliance period expired late last year. As part of this process, they are anticipating a pretty significant rehabilitation of the property to the sum of in excess of $50,000 a unit. The scope of work will include complete renovation of 60 residential units that have not been upgraded in the past few years. There will be upgrades to energy efficient appliances, new kitchens, new bathrooms, new floor coverings, refreshed paint. That's all within the residential units. And then additionally, all of the common areas will be updated with fresh paint, floor coverings, lightings, ceilings. Upgrades will be made to mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems, as well as the elevators. And then the exterior will receive new windows, installation of a new roof covering, and then they will install solar panels over the top of the new roof covering. The exterior will be, in addition to the new windows, the exterior will be reclad with a combination of drivet and aluminum panels. The drivet and aluminum panels will be replaced with new fiber cement panels. They have been working really hard to design their improvements with a focus on improving energy efficiency. And the ownership group is still in the process of researching and applying for numerous green grants, in addition to the refinancing that they're requesting from Rhode Island Housing. So that's kind of a quick summary. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Jeff. Now I'd like to request a motion to recommend approval of committee action item number 3, please.
Liz Tanner, so moved.
Second.
Great. Thank you both. Any comments or questions about this one?
I have one. There's a lot of neighborhood planning and neighborhood development that's going on in Oneyville. Is this consistent? Is the city signed off? Where are we in that process?
I don't know that they've had a lot of conversations with the city. I'm certainly happy to ask that and get back to you. You know, it's a completely existing project. There will be no change to the footprint or anything. You know, it's going to receive an extensive facelift on the exterior, but the majority of the improvements will be interior.
Nick, this is Carol. I think preservation of housing for seniors and disabled persons is totally in line with the City of Providence strategy on maintaining the housing that they have.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
I think this is a very solid proposal from an established organization that has a long history with the project, a nice large rehab, have the security of the Section 8 contract on 100% of the units. I don't have any questions about it. It looks like a great, great project. Liz, any comments or questions?
Nothing from me.
Okay, great. Then I would like to ask Corinne, please, to take a roll call vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Before I start the roll call vote, commissioners and staff, just a gentle reminder for the benefit of the public participating today and clarity in the record to please state your name prior to speaking each time. Now to the roll call vote. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for River Edge Apartments, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Ritsinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. This is Commissioner Orth. I'd now like to introduce committee action item number 4, which is a recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets and prepayment for Cove Properties. And I'd like to introduce Ann Berman, the Assistant Director of Development, who will present this action item. Ann, would you please take it away?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Ann Berman. This request for action is actually for two actions. The first is the approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest in Cove Properties, and the second is the prepayment of the first mortgage for Cove Properties. Cove Properties is located in North Kingstown. It consists of 18 apartments in 14 buildings. It was one of our first tax credit deals, having been developed in 1992 using low-income housing tax credits and financing from Rhode Island Housing. It's 28 years into its 30-year regulatory agreement, which expires in 2023. The original limited partner investor was the Rhode Island Equity Pool, which holds a 99% interest in the property. And the general partner interest is held by two individuals who have their own partnership. Cove Properties has signed a purchase and sale agreement with Valley Affordable Housing. Prior to selling the development, the general partner has requested that the equity pool transfer its interest to them, and the equity pool has agreed to this transfer. immediately after the transfer of the limited partnership interest, Cove LP will sell the development to Valley Affordable Housing, and Valley Affordable's affiliate, Pinnacle Property Management, will take over as the property manager. And Valley Affordable is working on several possible finance scenarios and is committed to operating the site as affordable housing well into the future. We did review this. This property has been the subject of conversation for a while, as the current general partner has been seeking to sell the property as the original developers have retired and moving on to other ventures. So this request for action is for two items. Cove Properties of Wickford Limited Partnership seeks approval of the transfer of the limited partnership from Rhode Island Housing Equity Pool to the current general partner, Cove Properties of Wickford, Inc., or its nominee. And then the second action is for the prepayment of the first mortgage for Cove Properties. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Anne. I'd now like to request a motion to recommend approval of this committee action item.
Liz Tanner, so move.
I think we're seeing a second.
Great. Thank you both. I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions on this one.
I have none.
Okay. I'll jump in. And with one, I see that purchaser, Valley Affordable Housing, intends to repay the accrued interest on the existing targeted loan, which is great to get that back. It does beg the question, I guess, for me at least, of why did the targeted loan have such a large accrued interest balance to begin with, and were there operational issues with the project in the past, and how's that looking going forward, if so?
This is a small development. Quite honestly, Kevin, I don't think that if this developer, in fact, I'm quite confident that if this developer had approached us, we probably would not have necessarily, move forward with this project. A, because the development is small and it's not necessarily the most cost-effective property in our portfolio, and the managing partners are relatively unsophisticated in the business. So we believe that the transfer to Valley Affordable is really in the best interest of the development. Valley has a fairly sophisticated management company. They are just completing Reynolds Farm, which is half a mile up the road in North Kingston, so there'll be some, effective economies of scale in terms of the management. They'll bring a much more professional management to the site. They do have three potential refinance scenarios, one with a 9%, one with a 4%, and one really just refinancing this as a standalone and operating it as an 80% development. There is actually also some undeveloped acreage associated with this, so there may be potential, new development in the future. So we do think that in the long run, this is in the best interest of the property.
Great. Thank you. I don't have any further questions. Hearing no other questions or comments, Corinne, I would now like to ask you to conduct a roll call vote, please.
This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of recommending the approval of the transfer of physical assets and prepayment for Cove Properties, say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Racines?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Again, this is Kevin Orth. I would now like to introduce committee action item number 5, which is the recommendation for approval of proposed 2022 qualified allocation plan. And I'd like to introduce Ann Berman again, who will present this action item for us.
Good morning. This is Ann Berman. We have before you today the 2022 qualified annual qualified allocation plan, which is an annual plan that is updated and outlines the lending criteria and the priorities for the state in regard to the low-income housing the 9% low-income housing tax credits. As in previous years, staff held meetings with stakeholders. This year, we held three really productive meetings. The group was a nice cross section of for-profit, nonprofits, policy folks from the United Way and Housing Works, as well as development consultants. The meetings were meaty. We really talked about the issues going on in the market today, rising construction pricing, overall costs, some of the metrics by which we analyze costs, changes in the community development section and the provision of services. I think what was really interesting was that the for-profits and the nonprofits and the policy folks were really pretty well aligned in terms of their comments and their suggestions, as well as their feedback for some of the items that we are considering proposing. And that was actually very helpful. So there was really a general consensus that, folks understand cost limits and, the importance of being efficient with their financing, but that the points are a little bit heavy in this category. And some stakeholders noted that, the emphasis on cost containment and finances may discourage investment in the areas where a little extra investment could be the difference between a good and a great project. So they asked us to consider various weighting categories in the financial leveraging section. And so our changes attempt to address many of their comments, while also being mindful of our fiduciary responsibility as the allocating agency to address some of our federal requirements and the cost containment concerns. I will not go through every change, but I thought it would be useful to highlight some of the ones that we thought were more pertinent. Feel free to stop me if I'm skipping over one that you'd like to ask some questions on. Just in regards to the Section 1, a lot of those were ministerial changes. There is a significant proposal in front of Congress to make some changes to the low-income housing tax credit program, so we wanted to modify the language a little bit so that if changes came through on the federal side, we would be able to implement those changes without having to come back and seek approval to amend the QAP. In Section 2, one of the things that we wanted to highlight was just kind of general information from an application perspective. There was some conversation with the stakeholders around a pre-application process and other states which have formal pre-application processes. And while we don't have a formal one and are not recommending that we institute that, we always encourage applicants to reach out and discuss their projects with us prior to submitting their application for feedback. And I think that's been a really useful exercise over the last couple of years. In terms of the scoring section, that's really where the bulk of the changes have been made. As you know, a couple of years ago, we did institute a what we call an unweighted total development cost cap, and we are proposing that it be increased from $375,000 to $385,000 per unit, given what is going on in the construction industry right now and the volatility in the construction market. We are reviewing the impact of the pandemic on construction costs in general, And we, as I mentioned, we did have a robust conversation with the stakeholders about costs. In addition to increasing the overall limit to 385, we're also suggesting that we eliminate the requirement for the capitalized new reserves from the TDC when we're reviewing those expenses. We are proposing that we modify the building types. We're adding, it's really more of a clarification based on some of the projects that we're receiving. We've sort of modified elevator versus non-elevator buildings and a podium building, whether it's over a garage facility or not. And our design and construction team is going back and doing some analysis around costs. I've seen emails as late as this morning sort of, talking about what the overall increase in the market has been, anywhere from, 6 to 12%. And then I got another email that says, wood has now gone down from $16 to $14 lineal foot. So, it's a bit of a challenge since we don't have a crystal ball, but when we release the handbook this year, it will have updated total development costs based on the type of construction, and we're just trying to tighten up the types of construction to be more consistent with the applications that we have received. One of the next big changes is we deleted points associated with the request for state and Rhode Island housing resources. In the previous years, it's been 10 points, and the metric was relatively low. I think it was $25,000 or less. And the reality is most applicants did not receive any points in that category. And this was a big discussion topic for the stakeholders. And we understand that trying to cap the soft costs was implemented to help with cost containment issues. However, we do cap the total development costs, and we score based on total development costs. So this is sort of the primary incentive for cost containment. Because we cap the amount of low-income housing tax credits allowed in any deal to 40% of our annual allocation, we are, in a sense, increasing the need for soft money. And we also recognize that we have additional COVID funding that we want to be able to, that we want to incentivize developers to use. So we think that by eliminating the scoring for the state funding, we are trying to balance these competing metrics. And I would also add that it does lead a little bit to this, sort of, I don't want to use the word gaming, but it's almost like gaming the scoring system. And so that's why we had a couple of applications that came in where it was a twinning deal and the 9% basically scored really high because they didn't need the soft money. And then they pushed all the soft money to the 4% deal, which isn't scored under this QAP. So we think this is a nice way to balance some of those various concerns. The next category was also under financial leveraging, and we're suggesting that we add points for the protection of three-bedroom or larger family units. You may recall that several years ago we eliminated a similar scoring metric, and then over the past several years we've funded quite a number of developments with one- and two-bedroom units rather than larger family units. And while developers do need to build to their market, we want to make sure that the scoring does not disincentivize developers to build family units because there is a need across all bedroom sizes. We moved some points associated with the opportunity zone and actually increased the number of points from one to two in an effort to actually incentivize folks to generate opportunity zone equity if they are in fact located in an opportunity zone. And then the next section of changes was in the comprehensive community development section. And these are pretty wholesale changes. that we think better align with current policy objectives and will better incentivize developers to meet those objectives. Several of the components were outdated. Some of them were not very competitive, so essentially every applicant was receiving those points, and they weren't necessarily incentivizing the kinds of buildings and developments that further state goals. So rather than several disconnected metrics, we've basically proposed creating criteria in three distinct areas: transit and connectivity, areas of opportunity, and then public engagement and services. again, I won't go through each of the items. A couple of items to note, we did reduce the amount of points associated with commercial square footage from 4 to 2. Part of that is a recognition that, you know, as a result of COVID, there's a lot of empty office space, so it's not necessarily the, you know, the most ideal time to be developing commercial space. And we sort of changed the metrics so that it should be any commercial development would be more geared toward you know, providing services for the community. The other big piece that I want to kind of identify, we are adding points for broadband, up to 2 points, depending on whether it's in the community room or within the actual residential units. And as a reminder, our design and construction guidelines require that, you know, these buildings be fully wired. That's sort of part of our basic design and construction guidelines. We are.
Well, so why, Anne, can I interrupt you if I could?
Sure.
Why not make the points, why not eliminate points, just make the broadband a requirement?
So,
Nick, it's Carol. Can you explain what you mean by that? You mean by why you want to make the service a requirement of the development?
Not necessarily, but the infrastructure behind it that puts it together.
Oh, yes.
I'm not familiar with
yes.
the details.
It is a requirement. What Anne is getting to is that the QAP will provide points for a developer who's actually providing the service next, not the hardware behind the scenes. We require that as part of our development activity anyway.
And what's the argument? I appreciate that clarification. It's helpful. And what's the argument of just having points and not going all the way to service?
I don't know financially that our developments would be able to bear those costs, Nick. I think it would be a question of whether or not we could finance the number of units that arguably we need to finance on an annual basis if we deploy our resources to pay for services, and our rents would not support net operating income that could pay for broadband for every individual that occupies our development. So,
have you done some pro formas that I could look at in that regard?
Happy to share with you our some rental pro formas, Nick. You know, mm-hmm. I know Mike DeCaro pulls operating data on our developments all the time. So it's really a balance of how much we can build and how much our developments can support. I mean, if you look at many, if not most, of the developments we finance in Rhode Island, they are not typically achieving a 60% tax credit rent, right? Our rents are more along the 50% tax credit rents or lower. And I know, Mike, you're on. Maybe you can speak to what we generally see as rent levels in our developments.
Yeah, Carol, I'm here. This is Mike DeCaro. So I think as we underwrite new deals, certainly with no subsidy, those higher income areas, the East Greenwich, the suburban areas, we can get close to 60%. But for the most part, our existing developments, we're probably, you know, with no subsidy, right around 50, 55 in that level. And that's close, that's tight. And without subsidy, I mean, our straight tax credit properties are typically, you know, working very hard to maintain like a 1.1, 1.2 debt coverage ratio. There's not a lot of extra in there. But we can certainly look at any data you want us to look at. We have several years of financial statements and monthly operating statements. We can certainly look at the numbers and provide you with anything you'd like to see.
Nick, I think one interesting opportunity is the broadband dollars coming into the state of Rhode Island as a result of the stimulus money. So there are opportunities for developers to apply for funding, depending on how the state rolls out these resources, which may allow for capitalization of some kind of broadband reserve. So we are at the table with the state as they talk through what potential opportunities they are looking to roll out. So we will be vocal about that, how important we think broadband is, particularly for our lower income developments and our public housing authorities as we move forward. But I just think it would be very difficult for us to finance the cost of broadband into the operations of each deal.
Right, and that's my last point. I can imagine the argument that there are things that developers want to do to their property, not necessarily need the financing of that. This is beyond just an incremental factor. It is more substantial than that.
Yes, but important. Important. So we do have our eye on this. We know it's important to the board. We know it's important to the leadership in the state. And certainly it's important for the people who need access to broadband. So we are actively working on this. We have a group that's working with the Innovation Office. And so we will stay on top of this and push this agenda as often as possible.
Okay. Thank you, Carol.
This is Commissioner Orth. I think I'll jump in while we're talking about this, areas of opportunity, and I know and you and others spent a lot of time in reworking this section, so I really appreciate it. I think it's a great product that you put out here. You have in the narrative under this areas of opportunity a couple of, I guess, four key areas, common indicators of areas of opportunity. But they were not, each of those four were not included as a point item. And so I'm wondering, say, economic growth and access to health care, could those indicators of areas of opportunity be incorporated as point items as well? And if did you consider it and found that it'd be too difficult to do so, or where do you stand on that?
I think it might be a challenge, but I think that's something we should go back and look at. We can work with. We are including some GIS mapping in here, which may help us identify those specific metrics. I don't think we thought about scoring them individually. But we're certainly happy to go back and look, and that's the beauty of having a draft plan and then opening it up for more public comment. Once I think we get the ideas out there, it will start to generate some additional conversation, so we're happy to take a look at that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I did want to highlight one additional change in this section. And that is in the points and criteria for the provision of services. We really took a look at kind of what our residents or what the residents of some of these developments really need, and are trying to sort of focus on service provision and incentivize services that best serve them. So you'll notice. Of course, I don't have the page with me right here, but we've actually created sort of a matrix. You can see it on page 42 of the black line, which kind of prioritizes supportive services. Apologies, I just noticed a typo there. Where you get points for child care and adult daycare and job training, and those might be worth more points than, say, a nutrition class or providing space for resident meetings, all of which are important. And again, you have to build to sort of what your market is and provide services that are most beneficial to the residents of your particular unit. So we don't want to dictate what those services might be, but we've kind of created a system of a chart identifying sort of prioritized supportive services, which we think will help focus some of the supportive services that developers are providing, and you know, kind of looking back at what we had in the last couple of years, it was it was relatively generic, and it didn't incentivize certain services over other services that might really provide more benefits. So that was the goal here. So those were that was the bulk of the changes in the comprehensive community development section. In the community section underneath this, this is the section where you would be awarded points for providing housing in communities that have less than 10% of the 10% of their share of the affordable housing, and it's kind of a either or scenario. We did add a third category here, and this would provide points for a development that is located in what's essentially an exempt community, but within that exempt community that there's a census tract with an average AMI that exceeds 100% AMI. So the example that the stakeholder who provided this comment suggested was, if it's on the east side of Providence, right, where it's a relatively high census tract, the city of Providence is an exempt community, but you're locating, regulated housing in a census tract in an area in that exempt community that, has could in some ways be defined as some of those metrics for areas of opportunity. So that was one addition that we made. And then there were a few more point modifications around some of the energy efficiency. And again, rather than going through each of these in detail, I'm happy to answer any questions. The one last thing I would note is once this is approved by the board next week, and we then publish it for public comment, we are planning to hold at least one public meeting in the middle of the public comment period. It will be hosted on a Teams platform, so we can encourage folks to participate. We will certainly share it with all of our stakeholders so they're aware of it. If necessary, we'll hold a second meeting to make sure that we're able to respond to all of the comments, and we always encourage folks to put their comments in writing and send them along as well. And so if all goes according to plan, we'll be back to the board in August for final approval. So I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Great. Thank you, Anna. That great presentation and also a lot of work that went into this draft. I have a motion to recommend approval of committee action number 5 to the board, please.
Liz Tanner, so moved.
Second.
Great. Thank you both. Any other comments or questions?
I have a couple of comments, Kevin. And it was a very good presentation, and it sounds like a really solid process. So congratulations to you and your colleagues for that overall. I just have a couple of questions. One, you've been around the agency a long time. Have we ever lowered the development ceiling?
I'm sorry, I did not hear. You're talking about the total development cost?
Yeah.
I don't recall that we've ever lowered it. However, there were several years where we didn't increase it. So within kind of that TDC, we have the housing buckets, and we have, over the last couple of years, I think over the last 4 years, we may have increased the, sort of the per unit, twice. But again, we are pretty stingy with that. Again, with the with the lens of cost containment, I think this year has been really a challenge, given what we know has gone on in the construction industry, and you know we're all reading about it in the paper, and sort of trying to balance what is reasonable, you know, response to kind of the what's going on in the market, but also tries to again, you know, push for cost containment, and we're always looking at our design and construction guidelines as well to try and make sure that we are not imposing costs, you know, unnecessarily by way of our guidelines.
Do you think it would be difficult for you to assemble a list of a chart of development ceiling, cost ceilings for each of the last 10 years or some period of time? Makes sense?
We should be able to pull that together. It might take
us a couple
weeks. Should be able to
That's
do
fine.
That.
No rush. And last question, last comment, and you covered a little bit in your presentation. Would you call this a pro-fair housing agenda, and have we done anything to make it more progressive in that regard? I feel that's one of the fundamental issues facing our society, and I'm just curious. I have no qualms with doing the right thing, but I'm just sort of curious whether this year we had more of an emphasis than in the past.
So we did talk about that both internally and with some of the stakeholders. We have a fairly robust fair housing section in the, I think, the section one of the QAP that, you know, was really beefed up over the last couple of years, both to be both from a, you know, with a state and federal lens on it. I think rather than you know, necessarily embedding specific, you know, points associated with fair housing, that the goal is that the document itself will, you know, sort of incentivize folks to develop housing across the state. And that in itself is sort of a fair housing lens.
That's great. I do note that time after time at our meetings, we have diversified locales or venues for our development. So it seems to be working, looking from a windshield.
This is Kevin Orth. I would add to that, Nick, that I think this inclusion of the 5 points, if that's finally approved for development in a census tract with a AMI over 100%, I think that could be go a long ways towards, you know, fair housing and
I agree.
Promotion.
I'm all set. Thank you, Kevin.
Okay, great. I had one other, more of a nit, I guess, than anything, and that is I noticed in reading through the black line of the QAP that there were a lot of stylistic changes throughout the document, which increased the use of acronyms. And I think certainly some of that is good because it speeds up the reading of the document and reducing kind of having to go through repeatedly the same long terminology. However, I think in some instances it's maybe been overused in the acronyms. And particularly for those that are maybe new to Rhode Island Housing's program or you know, coming from out of state, it might be a little bit off-putting just to have to what is a CAA and what do they mean by this other acronym? So maybe just take another look at that and certainly maybe just spell it all out maybe at the beginning of the paragraph and then maybe throughout if it's used repeatedly, then go to an acronym.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Sure. Great. Hearing no other comments or questions, I'd like, Corinne, if you would please take a roll call vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of recommending the approval of the proposed 2022 qualified allocation plan, say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Chairman Resina?
Here. Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
Thank you. The vote is unanimous.
Great. Thank you very much. That concludes our agenda items, and we'll now move to discussion. And as previously stated, we'd like to move up the discussion of the operating budget to the first item. So let's see. Who was?
I'll take it, Kevin. This is Carol.
You'll take it, Carol. Okay.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner
Carol,
Orr.
Carol, before you get started, let you know that I need to leave the meeting.
Oh, okay. All right, Liz.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz.
I have another meeting. Thank you.
Okay. So first I want to start with thank yous to my colleagues because, as you might imagine, putting together this budget was took a lot of work, right, because we have new federal programs and we're coming out of a pandemic. So to deliver this budget to the board in June when we traditionally do it in the fall, I have to congratulate Karen, her team, and Lisa Primiano and everyone else who helped pull this together. So today we're going to walk you through the proposed fiscal year 22 budget. We'll go through a number of documents which were uploaded for you, and it includes our projected revenue and expenses, our proposed agency-wide operating budget, our proposed program budget, and a few slides prepared by our finance group that you've seen in the past, which helps put into context the various divisions and how they all interact to upload into this overall budget. I'm going to provide a very brief overview of the operating and program budgets and then turn the discussion over to Kara so she can do a more detailed presentation of the components of the operating budget and statistics on our current and historical operations. The 22 budget anticipates that we will continue to have a large number of staff working remotely moving forward. We recently developed a remote work policy that I believe most all staff will take advantage of. I mean, maybe 10% of our staff will continue to work 5 days a week in the office, but generally I think the large proportion of our workforce will take advantage of the policy. It will permit staff to work remotely up to 3 days per week with approval of management. We've outlined three key highlights of the fiscal year 22 budget. We expect to have an increase in multifamily preservation transactions funded by taxable loans. We also anticipate homeownership loan production to increase slightly based upon last year's volume. We were pleasantly surprised. Single family production was a bit higher than expected given COVID and the constraints around, fire code and inspections that are required as part of the mortgage financing process. But it's great news for us and certainly for our borrowers that our business was up. On the expense side of the 22 budget, you'll note a higher than average increase in personnel expenses. And this is primarily due to the new federal programs that we will administer on behalf of the state. Generally, there's corresponding fee revenue to offset these expenses. Between the Rent Relief RI program and the Homeownership Assistance Fund, which will roll out a little bit later this year, we will be onboarding more than a dozen new employees. We propose a salary increase for staff in this budget of approximately 4%. Also, we anticipate an increase in health insurance costs naturally. We see an increase generally every year. So we've estimated what that hit will be to our budget, but we won't know the full impact of the overall increase until later this fall. Most importantly, we'll continue to invest in our technology, which has become even more critical for agency continuity with the number of staff we have and will continue to have working remotely in addition to the new programs that we are onboarding. So let me bring your attention to page 5, which outlines the 22 projected revenue, which is a conservative but realistic projection. Net interest income was impacted by the pandemic and will likely continue to be, given the number of loans in forbearance right now. We expect that this will continue into the 22 fiscal year. As I mentioned previously, fee income and operating expenses will be higher based on the addition of the new federal programs, and we will be increasing our loan loss reserve for by approximately $3 million. Overall,
Carol, Carol, this is Kevin. Can we jump in with questions as you go? Go right ahead.
I'll probably pull on Kara, Kevin, as we go along for if you're, you know, there are very detailed questions. But please do.
Okay. With the loan losses, how did you measure, I guess, that would be sufficient, that you're comfortable with that number?
Mm-hmm. I'll turn it over to Kara. I mean, this addition to the loan loss reserve is really attributable to our multifamily lending. But Kara, would you like to weigh in on your process for that?
Yes, thank you. This is Kara. Good morning, Commissioners. So for the loan loss reserve, our total reserve is actually $47 million. So that is for our total portfolio, both single family and multifamily development loans. We are adding $3 million to that to bring it up to $50 million. And, you know, the process really is looking at our single family delinquency, looking at our single family losses, and historically what our losses have been. And then on the multifamily side, you know, looking at the individual developments that are part of our risk rating scoring, and the ones that are below 1.0 debt service coverage, and actually looking at their values. And so this is a process that we do with the auditors, and they do a pretty extensive review of that. I would say it is more focused on the multifamily this year because we have shifted the majority of our single family loans to fully insured loans. So the amount of uninsured single family loans that we have in the portfolio has gone down quite a bit. And the ones that we have typically have 20% of equity already in their home. And while we do have, you know, many loans still in forbearance and high delinquency right now as we're working through people hopefully, you know, getting reemployed. Many of those loans are insured. And in fact, looking at those still in forbearance, there's only about 3% of the loans in forbearance that have no insurance at all. And then there's another 5% that have MI insurance, which is, you know, 20 to 30% of the loan value. The rest are 100% insured. So we're really shifting our focus. With the single family, we've got more insurance. We are experiencing less losses, and we believe that will continue. And then on the multifamily, it's more about the value of those properties. And we are adding, you know, some larger multifamily loans, so we want to make sure we have adequate coverage for those loans.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful.
So overall, we anticipate net revenue of $8.3 million for fiscal year 22. We believe the net income projected in the 22 budget allows us to meet the needs of the Rhode Islanders needing our assistance while ensuring the financial soundness of the agency. So
Carol, I'm going to jump in again here.
Go ahead.
This is Kevin. Would you be able to provide the forecasted for fiscal year 2022, the net equity to assets ratio, return on assets, and the loan to assets?
Yes, we'll provide. We can provide that report to you.
Great.
We'll provide it to the board. Yeah, okay. We can do that. The ratios that we typically provide for you, correct, Kevin? That we usually do
yes.
on a quarterly
yep.
basis.
Yep.
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 We can do that.
And I guess I was. Keying in on the net equity to assets ratio. I know that's been under some pressure lately, so just want to see how that's looking given this budget.
Yeah,
good enough. We can provide that. So now if I could move you on to page 3 of the presentation, and I'm hoping that you have numbers down at the bottom of your sheet. This is the program budget for fiscal year 22, and it's broken out into five different categories. So the first category is preventing homelessness. And we're proposing level funding of a number of programs to prevent homelessness. Largely, though, these are rental assistance programs, most of them legacy programs. For example, the Neighborhood Opportunities Program and, you know, State RAP, they are legacy programs that have been dwindling down in terms of the expense to the agency because we've been working very hard to move people on these programs into mainstream resources like tenant-based vouchers, mainstream vouchers, et cetera. The second area is support for our community development activities. We have LISC here again. LISC operates the NDF program, and we've been funding this program for a very long time. It allows LISC to leverage Section 4 dollars on a federal level, and it provides programs for capacity building for nonprofits. And I'm pleased that we've seen a bit of an expansion of the folks that LISC is doing business with now. So they've actually expanded and broadened their NDF program to include public housing authorities and other folks that in the past were never included in this program. So we're requesting level funding for NDF moving forward. Then we have our community support programs. We're requesting an increase in our digital equity initiative. We had a lot of demand for this funding, and I think we presented these recommendations to the board at the last meeting. So we're requesting an additional $200,000 for this program. And then our community development and housing programs. These are the programs like financial literacy for home buyers, financial literacy for our renters. That's what these programs are, and they should be coming to the board. If they're not coming to the board this month, they'll be coming to you in August. So we are looking for a slight increase in this program. We are recommending funding a little bit higher than $1 million for a down payment assistance borrowers who don't qualify for our 10K DPA. We're proposing this to support, portfolio growth with this so that we actually have a product that can serve another side of our borrowing area. And lastly, we want to continue our partnership with the Office of Energy Resources and National Grid by continuing to fund the ZEOS program. You may recall last year we funded 15 homes under the program with the resources provided by Rhode Island Housing and also OER. So let me stop there, and if you have questions on the program budget, I'm happy to answer those questions. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Kara to do a deep dive into the balance of the presentation.
This is Kevin. Kara, please go ahead, Nick.
Sorry. Kara, that was a great presentation. I'm just sort of curious, Kara, to what extent have we had ongoing contact with our auditors? Because some of these are judgmental calls, loan reserve and the like. How up to date are they in this discussion?
Sure, this is Kara. The auditors actually look at our financials on a quarterly basis. So they're not doing a full analysis of all the loans, but they see how the loans have changed. They look at our delinquency, how the loan balances have changed, and what categories of loans are increasing or are going delinquent. So, you know, every 3 months they are looking at those kinds of estimates.
Okay, thank you.
This is Kevin. In regards to the program budget, this is very helpful. I know it's, you know, we've been doing this for a little while, but I like, it's always helpful to me to see where our priorities are. With this, you know, $4 million roughly that we have to spend on kind of ancillary programs, I guess, outside of our mainstream funding programs. What strikes me kind of sitting back and kind of assessing this is the absence of at least clearly stated kind of reversing housing segregation and actively promoting activities that increase housing opportunities for persons of color who've, you know, historically been shut out from these opportunities. So I think it's more than, you know, semantics and you know, saying, oh, well, this program fits that, we'll just rename it. But should I'm thinking that we should make that a higher priority. And I don't know, maybe if the down payment assistance, maybe that's a big one. Maybe that's going towards it. But maybe could you speak to that, Carol?
I certainly can. It's not really at the forefront of, you know, the titles of the program. So we do have two initiatives that we will be kicking off. One is an escrow program, right? It's a mortgage product through our loan center that is accompanied by an escrow for borrowers who, if they get into trouble, if something happens along the way, an unexpected car issue, something breaks down in the home, this escrow will be used to pay their PD for them so that they can cover those expenses and not get behind on their mortgage, right? Not put them into a position of having to go into forbearance. So we have that product that we're going to be rolling out later this month. We also have a second product that we're going to fund with our federal home dollars, which is a down payment assistance program that will be targeted to residents in our minority census tracts. So we'll provide up to $25,000 in down payment assistance for people living in minority census tracts so that they can buy a home in any census tract that they wish. So it's not something that's going to show up on this program budget, Kevin, but we are working aggressively to increase opportunities for minority households within the state.
So I guess what I heard from that is we have programs in place, but also new ones that are going to be rolling out, primarily funded through federal dollars. Is that right?
Well, the down payment assistance program is certainly funded by federal dollars. And I think if you look to the community support programs that we fund with our resources, we tend to fund programs in the urban core, right? Programs in Oneyville that are educating people that are educating youth that are living in our developments. I think you would look at Oneyville as being a minority census tract. I think a lot of the work we do is within the urban core, really getting to people that need the financial literacy, need to move from renting to homeownership. So while it doesn't, you know, while it doesn't, the title doesn't resonate with people maybe about the work we're doing in our minority neighborhoods, that's essentially what we're doing. I mean, if I broke down what these groups and organizations like Amos House and Providence CAP and other organizations are doing, that's exactly the goal of their program is to move people from shelter into permanent supportive housing, into stable rental housing, into home ownership across the continuum of, you know, trying to build wealth in their house.
It's, in a sense, to use today's vernacular, it's an asset building strategy.
It really
for minorities.
Is. Yeah.
Is,
it
is
really
there
is.
A way, and I think to Kevin's point, which is a good one, it's more than a name change. It's an issue of designing programs that are more likely to achieve that overarching objective of asset building.
Mm-hmm.
As well as modifying existing programs that can do that.
Yeah.
So
when,
whenever you come to a fork in the road, you pick the fork that aims to serve the indigenous low-income minority community.
Yes. And I think while as the board, you know, as the board and seeing something like this and seeing a title like community development and housing programs, you know, it doesn't tell the whole story, right?
Right.
So maybe we need to do a better job of doing that. But if you look at the underlying awards, not only just on the community development activity, but also on the digital equity initiative, I think if you look at the underlying programs and organizations that are participating in these programs and the work that they do, you would see that that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to build wealth and to move people on to homeownership where they can build their wealth, which is the way most people do build wealth.
Is there a way to make sure, as Nick mentioned, that that is kind of forefront in the mind of designing the programs to achieve this outcome of reversing segregation and increasing opportunity? I know that we haven't done, you know, a full review of our programs and, you know, and have a roadmap like that, but I'd like to see that it's just a more, bright-lined area of our activity.
Okay. So let me mull that. Let me talk with our comm staff and our policy staff about how we achieve that to better illuminate the work we do. I think we do it now. And maybe it's just a matter of showing you how we get from A to Z and what processes we go through internally when we think about programs and strategies, so that we're not duplicative of efforts being undertaken by municipalities and state government and some federal programs that come down into the state of Rhode Island. Rather, we're supporting the efforts of folks that are receiving resources from a number of different areas.
Okay. And I'm sorry not to belabor this more, but is there, if we've got $4.6 million of our own internally generated funds to put out to what we consider programs of priority, is it possible for you to let me know what percentage of this is going towards, you know, promoting housing opportunity?
Absolutely. Happy to do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
Yep. I'll write something up. Any other questions before I turn it over to Kara? Okay. So, Kara, can I turn it over to you? One other thing I will mention that, of course, isn't included in this because it's not necessarily this is really our operating dollars, the programs that we're supporting. Overall, we're proposing to invest more than $113 million in the Rhode Island economy for production, preservation, and other related activity. So it's, you know, this is just a very small piece of the pie that we're investing in communities across the state. The other resources, like our bond financing and federal programs and state programs, and of course the trust, all told is almost $114 million. So I'll leave you with that, and let me turn it over to Kara.
Thank you, Carol. This is Kara. Carol did a great summary of page 5, the revenues and expenses. A couple of other things just to highlight on that page. We talked about fee income, and that increase is primarily due to those federal programs, which is truly just a pass-through to us. The fee income will offset the increase in operating expenses needed to run those programs. But if we strip out those programs, you would see that fee income still has an increase of about $1 million, and that's primarily related to the multifamily development loans that we anticipate closing in the upcoming year, and fees related to the leased housing division and some of the programs that they run. you'll also notice an increase in the gain on sale of loans. And as mentioned, we expect an increase in our homeownership production. I think last year's budget, we were somewhat conservative, not knowing how the pandemic would impact that business line. But, we were, very happy to see that it continued to be strong, and we anticipate that going into fiscal 22, that will continue. We talked about loan losses and expenses, our programmatic expenses, and then again with the operating expenses, if you strip out those new federal programs, so we have, a little more apples to apples, there is still an increase, but it's about a 5% increase. So it's a little hard to see that with all the new programs added in, so I just wanted to point that out. As Carol mentioned, we've included a couple of graphs, page 6, which we have done in prior years. Page 6 shows revenues and expenses by division, so you can see each business line individually and what they contribute, what their percentage is of the total revenues and total expenses.
Carol, this is Kevin, a question about that. So
sure.
If I'm looking at both of these graphs, and I'm, say, looking at home ownership, it says it's 26% of revenue and 29% of expenses. So within that category of home ownership, so would all borrowing costs, such as our, when we go out to the bond market and then have to pay debt service on that, is that included as an expense? And conversely, are all loan revenues from the individual loans we make included in total revenue? So are we getting a true picture of the net revenue by division with these graphs, or are they kind of mixed up a bit so that's not really accurate?
So it does include all of the costs, but this is not net revenue by division. It's kind of breaking out revenue by division and expense by division. If we looked at just net revenue by division, looking at it this way, it looks like, home ownership expenses are higher than revenue. But when you look at it on a net revenue basis, you can see that it is contributing to the overall net revenue.
Okay. So I guess that would be a question then for me is, where is the bulk of our net revenue coming from?
Yeah, I would say the majority is going to be coming from the development division, the multifamily rental development division, probably 60%, maybe 30% from home ownership, and the balance from loan servicing and leased housing.
Okay, great.
Karen, does this include administrative and cost allocation?
It does. Yes, it does.
It does. And how do you calculate that? Give me an example.
Sure. So for all the overhead type expenses, which would be executive division type expenses, communications, legal, facilities, finance, IT, we go through each of those divisions. We speak to the various directors to think about how much time they are spending on each of the business lines. And allocate it that way. There are certain functions that it's a direct line. We know that this particular council, works only with this division, so we can easily allocate that. But in other cases, it's more of a judgment call on, how much time, effort is spent on each person. For facilities, it would be more of a square footage calculation. For HR, it would be based on how many employees are in each division. So, we look at each line item a little bit differently.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I find this exceedingly helpful.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I know we talked about this for maybe not recently, but in the past a lot. So this is very helpful. And is it possible just to throw in a third with net revenue?
We can, yes. We can provide that.
I mean, if it's not that much work, I think that'd be nice to wrap it up in that way.
Sure. Moving on to slide number 7, that is the historical budgeted revenue amounts for the past 5 years. It shows each of our main categories of net interest income, fee income, and gain on sale of loans. And you can see how fiscal 22 compares to the prior years. Page 8 is the expenses, similar chart of 5 years history of our budgeted expenses, showing loan losses, program expenses, and operating expenses. And again, it is a little skewed with those additional federal programs mixed in. And then the two final pages of the presentation are what we have traditionally included. It has a lot of detail on it. It is the details of our operating expenses compared to prior year budget and prior year actual. This includes those new federal programs, which are about $9.1 million in expenses. There are additional staffing for those programs that are included. If we back those programs out, again, our overall increase in our budget is about 5%. I think it's 5.1%. And as we've discussed, that increase really is related to we've got some additional temporary staffing, which has actually been very helpful, I think, in the servicing division and reaching our delinquent borrowers and really trying to get people, you know, back into a payment plan or back into paying their mortgage. There's increase in health insurance. We have an increase, a merit increase for staff and some increases in technology. Otherwise, it is fairly representative of our prior year's type of expenses. If there are any, it's a lot of information, so if there are any light items you want us to discuss a little bit more in detail, I can do that.
This is Kevin. I've got a question about the payroll taxes and other benefits. If I just add up the salaries and the temporary help, and then you add up all the associated taxes and benefits, it's looking like taxes and benefits are approximately 48% of the base payroll cost. To me, in my industry, that's exceedingly high. From a development and property operations standpoint, where does that sit? I don't know, maybe with our HFA peers or other state entities, or do you know?
So I don't know that comparison specific to other HFA entities. One thing that I will note is related to our post-retirement benefits expense. For budget 22, it's an $800,000 number. So this is, we don't have a defined benefit program, but this works. This is for health insurance for retirees. It is calculated similar to that, where there are actuarial assumptions about how many people will take this benefit and how long they live. And, you know, based on our entire number of employees, number of workers. It's not an actual cost. It's something that it's a benefit, but it's a projection of what we might have to pay out in the future. So that does skew the numbers somewhat. We have talked about our health insurance. We look at that every year. It's a decent program for our employees, but it is a very useful tool, I think, in recruitment. Sometimes we might struggle in other ways with recruitment, and being able to provide a good health insurance plan to our employees has been helpful. So I think those are some of the items that make it look, kind of rich in terms of employee benefits.
But do you have a, I mean, is there any benchmark out there as you're crafting budgets to look at?
So we have a consultant that we are using to review our benefits, and it's something that they look at every year. This year we're also getting a consult, or we're updating our consultant to do a salary survey to make sure our salaries are in line. So there is some benchmarking that they do for us in terms of our benefits. And that's something that we look at every year. And again, it's really the determination of, you know, what benefits are appropriate versus what our salaries are and, you know, what our employees, you know, what work life is for our employees.
Okay. I don't have any other questions about this. I appreciate the great presentation here and all the work that went into this.
Kevin, may I just regroup with you to ensure that we get back to you with the information that you've requested? You would like the ratio report, which includes our net equity to assets, and you would like some additional information on how our programs relate to moving people into wealth building opportunities and investment in minority communities?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like, Nick, anything else in addition to what we presented that you would like to see?
Just what you just summarized for Kevin before.
Okay. Kevin, anything else that you'd like to see?
I think the third item, as I asked Kara about, was if possible, that third chart of net revenue by division.
Third chart. Yep. Okay.
And I made a couple of requests to Ann. That's a part of it.
Yep. I'm sure she has those, Nick. Yeah. We will circle back on those.
I know that this meeting has gone on. We've had a lot of good things to talk about, but I want to be conscious of staff time and Nick, your time. Another item is this naturally occurring affordable housing loan program, which I'd like to give its due because I think it's a great program that is, you've put together here. Nick and Carol, would you like to continue with that, or do you want to... Okay. Great. Well, I think Anne, would you like to lead off the discussion with this, please?
Sure. And Mike Liberatore is going to jump in as well. He really did a great job helping to put this together. But essentially, our goal is to create a loan product that. Would be available for both nonprofit and for-profits who identify what we call naturally occurring affordable housing that's existing in the market. And, you know, these opportunities sort of come along, you know, in a cyclical nature, but essentially they are sort of small apartment buildings, typically under 30 units, say 10 to 30 units. The rents in the existing units are typically at or below 80% area median income. You know, they're in fair condition, they go on the market. And, you know, the goal here is to help developers identify 40% of the units remain affordable, so below 80% AMI after the transfer of the property, because typically in a market rate situation when an apartment building trades, there's an automatic increase in the rents here. And the goal here is to try and finance those properties so that you know, we can add some level of affordability going forward. Mike, do you want to kind of give an overview of the program? And I will say for Nick's benefit, we had a very thoughtful conversation with Kevin last week about this program. We've made a couple of tweaks to it since. But Mike, if you want to go ahead and kind of give a quick summary for Nick and Kevin, that would be great.
Sure. This is Mike Liberatore. You know, the purpose of this program was to, you know, to serve Rhode Island Housing Commission to preserve affordable housing units, and the goal was to do it without using soft sources. So these units are existing, they're occupied. Like Ann said, they're in fairer condition. And these transactions are happening every day. Rhode Island is not a part of these transactions. Rhode Island Housing is not. Most often, borrowers will use either cash, hard money, or a conventional financing, you know, from banks such as Washington Trust. So this program could help CDCs, certainly, as well as for-profit borrowers who perhaps do not meet the liquidity requirements of conventional banks, or borrowers who don't want to pay hard money interest rates, which could be, you know, north of 12%. In exchange, you know, we can provide them with finance that would restrict 40% of the units to, you know, affordable rates under 80% AMI. So that will help us serve our mission, and at the same time would give the borrowers the benefit of favorable financing. While our interest rates might be higher than conventional finance, again, it'll be lower than hard money interest rates, and we're offering a loan-to-value ratio that's a little bit higher than conventional, which would be up to 90% loan-to-value. I'm sure there are a lot of questions, and we did our best to think through as much as we could, but you know, this is a work in progress, so we're happy to take feedback.
This is a sweet spot for lenders. We're going to be moving into their space, and how do we find out where the good ones are? How do we become partners? Just help me understand where it fits in the broader marketplace.
I think we're trying to differentiate. Sorry, Ann.
Nope. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. I think we're trying to differentiate, and obviously that's you know, we can't compete with Washington Trust. They offer lower interest rates, no reserves or escrow requirements. They just have a better product. But where we can do better, perhaps, is in the debt to value ratio. But we're talking about, you know, working with borrowers who have more of a longer term goal. Obviously, the CDCs that are mission driven, but some of the younger developers, maybe with less access to liquidity, who wouldn't normally qualify for conventional finance. There may be some overlap, but I think we're trying to hit a market that's kind of not that's kind of untapped right now.
And Nick, this is Ann. I just want to add to that. In addition to what Mike said, we actually reached out and spoke to a couple of lenders. We spoke to Laurel Bowerman at Washington Trust. And I think it was a very helpful conversation because it really kind of reminds us that we're underwriting the real estate and we're also underwriting the developer. You know, and I think what differentiates us is that we're willing to work with developers who have probably lower liquidity than what a conventional bank may be willing to offer. You know, so 90%, you know, Washington Trust is not going to make a loan at 90% loan to value, and that really is you know, kind of the differentiating factor. And you know, it comes with a higher interest rate, but, you know, we have, in addition to speaking with a couple of lenders, we have reached out to the market and spoken with several developers, you know, smaller developers about this product, and I think they're willing to pay the higher interest rate in return for the higher loan to value.
this is a market that's been chased for a long time. I good luck on it going forward. You might want to have a conversation with the Federal Home Loan Bank of Boston and finding out what they think is going on in the marketplace.
Okay. Happy to do that.
This is Kevin. One item I know Nick is of interest to you that's not discussed in here, Ann and Mike, is the if there's any limitation on a cash out refi. If you're looking at a competitive product such as a HUD 223F, on a cash out refi, it'd be limited at 80% loan to value. Are you thinking of doing any other kind of limitation like that? Or it's an existing owner of the property?
We haven't thought about it, I think, in detail. We certainly can. It's a good point. Many of these, I think most of these are going to have loans in the $2 to $4 million range. We're sort of hoping for sort of long-term stability here. We did build in, after our discussion last week, we've kind of built in the notion that you could potentially underwrite to the post-rehab rents with sort of a stepped payout of the loan. Right, so we'll pay out the as-is value, and then when they achieve those post-rehab rents, they get the balance of the debt. I think one item where we need to sort of think through is sort of how long we're willing to have an interest-only period. Right now it's 18 months. So I think, that's part of the refi opportunity. We should look at that in the context of, if we're underwriting to the as-is or the post-rehab rents. But thank you for pointing that out.
And then another one that we discussed is the affordability restrictions, whether it would be just rent or rent and income. And I think that you were leaning towards rent and income. And if so, that obviously has compliance implications. And I think this type of program, which you try to have, is I think you definitely did, and conceiving of it, a lighter touch, certainly, than our tax credit funding programs and so forth.
Yes, and we've reached out to asset management, and they've met internally and provided some feedback to Mike and I that we are in the process of digesting now, so that we kind of figure out what that fine line is. There's probably more compliance here than there would be on the workforce side, but certainly much less than there would be on our traditional tax credit deals. I think we've got to find that right kind of middle ground. But that's in process. We can certainly share that with you once we finalize it.
Okay, great. And I think hitting on 20 years of compliance is a good way to go.
Thank you.
I think this is very well conceived, well presented. I think with just a little bit more thought on a couple of these items, would be great to just get it rolled out and see how it competes out there and helps out there.
Great. Well, we hope to, we're talking to a couple of folks now, and hopefully by the fall we'll have a proposal to bring to you.
Okay.
The challenge is these properties, when they're on the market, they move very quickly. That's which can sometimes be a challenge for us. There's so much competition, but we'll keep working at it.
Great. I think we need to adjourn now, unless there is any things very significant that you'd like to bring to the attention of Nick and I on the pipeline report.
Nope, there's nothing of note. We've pretty much talked about everything.
Good work.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Corinne, do we need to have a, since it's just Nick, do we need to have a formal vote for adjournment or?
Well, we typically do. This is Corinne Myers speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of adjourning the meeting, say aye. If you're opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman North?
Aye.
Chairman Ritsina?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, Kevin.
Have a great day. Thank you.